Thank you. All right. Last perspective, chapter 4, mostly, but really the whole book. Here's something you should realize, and that is that people have often assumed that when it comes to this issue of evangelism, that it started just about 30 A.D. So when you read the book of Acts, you think, okay, now that is the unfurling, the unfolding of this thing that we call evangelism, or a thing that is more and more part of our vernacular in the age of the emergent church, is to talk about our being missional, that we are a missional church, or that we are a missional people. But the truth is that evangelism, outreach, this missional thrust is far older than that. And the book of Jonah really is a classic study in evangelism. If I were to say to you, give me a New Testament book that really helps us understand what the outreach of the church should look like and what it might give us in terms of hints about what matters and so forth, many people would choose the book of Acts. I personally wouldn't. I would back it up at least four books: Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. But seldom do you hear people say, oh, give me an Old Testament example of a book or a narrative that really helps me to comprehend the heart of God when it comes to evangelism. And I would say to you, it is the book of Jonah. The irony is, of course, that the book of Jonah gives us every single idea of what not to do. It's the complete opposite of a how-to book. It really is how not to. Understand one other thing. The book of Jonah appears in the Old Testament and is really God's commentary on the nation of Israel, who utterly blew their assignment. And that was to be a what to the nations? A light. They were miserable light keepers. Miserable light keepers. Jonah is also, I believe, a book for the New Testament church, and I think it is most prophetically a church parable for today, especially in the experiment of the American church. I think if we needed a prophetic book to speak to the church today, I might well lean on the book of Jonah to remind us of how we really do not get it. And if we don't get it soon, there is a lot at stake. The people who get it, quite frankly, are those who dominate the church in the third world countries. So people in Africa and India and Asia and Korea and the Philippines and Central America and South America, there the church gets it. And I welcome the day when all of those countries see our plight and send their missionaries to us, because I believe there will come a time when we will need them. Now I'll tell you why. And it's in the fourth chapter. So tell me, first of all, if I'm too hard, if you think I'm too harsh. But I find Jonah to be a pouting, self-righteous, nationalist, racist son of God. I was going to add a few more, but I thought, we're time limited here. A pouting, self-righteous, racist, nationalist son of God. Here's why. Jonah made enemies. Now listen to my phrasing here. Jonah made enemies of those that he believed were God's enemies. At the heart of white supremacy lies the notion that we know who God doesn't like. And God does not like black people. He doesn't like Asians either. In fact, from a white supremacist perspective, he doesn't like almost everybody else who isn't like him or her. But it is we who decide that it's we who decide who God's enemies are. But never do we really understand just who God's enemies are, because it's not nationally bound. It's not race bound. It is not a lot of things bound. That is, those who become the so-called enemies of God. Jonah did not want good to come to those that he hated. He wanted nothing less than destruction. Jonah firmly believed that he was God's favorite. Now, I have said to you after every sermon I've taught here that you are what? God's beloved. But I never said that you were his favorite. Have you ever noticed that? I never told you that you were his favorite. See, I'm not like your parents who have you grow up in this myth that you really are their favorite. You don't want to be your parents' favorite. The expectations on you when you are your parents' favorite is just, well, it just breaks the human spirit. But to be your parents' beloved child, that changes everything. And I don't have time to dig further into that. Jonah believed that he was God's favorite, a Jew who kept the law. And for the ancient Israelites, and even for the Israelites of Jesus' day, the law was everything. Jonah believed that only if you live a good moral life did you get a good life. If you lived a good moral life, you got a good life. And if you didn't live a good moral life, then you got punishment and destruction. So the people of Nineveh had not lived a good life, so they deserve destruction. In the economy of the prophet Noah and in the economy of the Israelites, generally speaking, the Ninevites and anyone outside the race was considered fair game for punishment and destruction. That's just the way it was. Now, when we get to the New Testament, we discover that things have not necessarily changed. So I want to ask you, is there anyone in the New Testament that reminds you, that in a sense captures a sort of New Testament version of the person of Jonah? Is there anyone in the New Testament that would remind you of Jonah? In fact, it's one of the reasons why the story even exists. Pardon? Not Saul. I mean, Saul would certainly be an example of that. But Saul was really down on who? He was down on Jews, right? He was on these Jews who had become Christians. But that's not as bad as another story. No, but boy, you sure hit it. Pardon? The sons of thunder? Okay, so you're all close. Sheesh. You know, I hate it when I know the answer and it's not Peter. So let me just introduce you to him. I'm sure you've never heard of him before, but I'll just ask it in the form of a question. Could Jonah be the elder brother in the parable of the prodigal son? Well, yeah,
Never thought of him.
Think of the story. The younger brother squanders everything that his father had that was good. He squanders his father's gifts. And from Jonah's perspective, that is what the Ninevites did. And his younger brother sleeps with prostitutes, which is a whole separate commentary on human sexuality. But it really, more than anything, is a commentary not on women, but it's really more of a commentary on men, this whole issue of prostitution. It's more a men's problem than it has ever been a woman's problem. And so the older brother looks askance at his younger brother and does not desire good for him. So let me read you just the tail end of the prodigal, of the older brother. We'll pick it up in verse 25. If you want to look on, it's good because the wording there is significant. So Luke 15, verse 25. Now, his elder son, that is the father, so the younger son has already come home, was in the field. And when he came and approached the house, he heard music and dancing. He called one of the slaves and asked what was going on. And he replied, "Your brother has come, and your father has killed the fatted calf, because he got him back safe and sound." Then he became angry and refused to go in. He became angry. He became angry. What does God ask Jonah? Do you have a right? Do you have a right to what? To be angry. And the older brother became angry and refused to go in, to go into the celebration of redemption. His father came out and began to plead with him. Imagine the father pleading with the older son, which is precisely what God does with Jonah. But he answered his father, "Listen, for all these years I have been working like a slave for you, and I have never disobeyed your command." You see, the older brother holds the moral high ground. He is the epitome of the rule keeper, the law keeper. Yet, you have never given me a young goat so that I might celebrate with my friends, let alone a fatted calf. You've never so much as even given me a goat, which in the food chain of that day was considered, you know, like eating at McDonald's versus, you know, the 1913 room or something like that. Verse 30. But when this son of yours, not my brother, see, he can't be my brother. Why can't he be my brother? Because he doesn't stand on the moral ground that I stand on. He is far below me in so many regards. So he can't possibly be my brother. Just like Jonah cannot conceive of the fact that the Ninevites could possibly be sons and daughters of Adam and Eve. That they could possibly be the sons and daughters of God. So, this son of yours comes back, who has devoured your property with prostitutes. You killed the fatted calf for him. Then the father said to him, Son, you are always with me, and all that is mine is yours. But we had to celebrate and rejoice because this brother of yours was dead and has come to life. He was lost and now is found. So, here we have the case of two missing sons. Two sons that are lost. That has got to be a heartbreaking experience for this father. I can't imagine. I have two children, a son and a daughter. Now, my son is not a believer. He does not follow Jesus. He doesn't attend church. But I wouldn't paint him out to be a person of the kind of lifestyle that is portrayed here in the younger son. Now, I have a younger daughter who has kept her moral grounding, who does embrace Christ and allows Christ to embrace her. But it would be absolutely inconceivable to me that if my son were to come home and that he was to tell me that somehow he had given his life over to Christ, that my daughter would refuse to come into the house and celebrate her brother's homecoming in the truest sense of that word. It would absolutely devastate me. But I'll tell you why it would devastate me. It isn't because of my son's condition, but it would be that all this time I had believed that I only had one lost child, only to discover that I had two children that were lost. Both of them had been lost all this time, and I didn't see it until the older brother comes home, the oldest child, rather, comes home. It would be devastating for me. How devastating it must have been for this father to find this out. He refuses to go in to the party. And so what does he do? He stays on the edges. And what does he do? He does what every adolescent worth the title of adolescence does. He pouts. Because pouting has power. You know that because many of you exercised it. I still pout. If I don't get my way, I pout. You've never seen a man my age pout. Paul, don't I pout? Paul has seen me pout. It's not pretty. Look, let me show you this painting by Rembrandt. Rembrandt understood, I think, much of what was taking place in this is his painting, his artistic version of the homecoming of the younger son. Now, there is far too much to talk about, and many of you have probably studied this painting, but I want to just point out a couple of significant things to you. I want you, well, first of all, I'm going to ask you this question. What do you see? So just, what is it that you see? Just take inventory of all the things you see. This is an astounding picture. I wish we had just lots and lots of time to talk about it. But you got to notice from the bottom of the picture, one shoe off, one shoe on. You got to notice the hands of the father. And if you're a real astute observer, you'll need to ask some questions about the hands of the father. And remember, this is Rembrandt's understanding of God. But one of the hands is very masculine. The other hand is very feminine. You notice that the father is stooped over his son. You notice where the son's head rests. It rests in his bosom, close to his father's heart. And there's so much more we can talk about in terms of the colors and so forth. But what I really want you to do in terms of tonight's perspective is to look at the older brother who is standing. Part of him is off the picture, or should I say, out of the picture. Out of the picture. Notice, well, let me just ask you, what do you notice about the older brother who is standing, besides the fact that he's out of the picture? What do you notice? Anybody? Pardon? No, he's not. He's off to the right. He's the one who's standing. Pardon? Right. He is physically completely detached. How else is he detached? Pardon? He won't look at him. Yeah, we're not really sure who he's looking at, right? What else? He's looking very dignified. In fact, he almost looks what? Self-righteous. That's the posture, by the way, of self-righteous, which is directly opposite of the brother, who is in a what posture? A humble and penitent, contrite posture. What else is the older brother doing? He's standing erect, right? He's what? Is he on the same level as the father? The same level as the brother? No. He is up. He is on a higher moral plane, even than his father. He is as much judging the father as he is the younger brother. And how are his hands extended? Look at the hands of the father. How are his brother's hands extended? Closed. Closed. And there's so much more we can know. But Rembrandt catches it. This is Jonah's New Testament counterpart. It's the counterpart to Israel. It's the counterpart, to a large extent, historically, of the church. A church that chooses to stand outside, determining who God's enemies are, and then hating them and keeping their distance from them. He is angry with the Father because the Father has shown mercy. Just like Jonah outside Nineveh, the elder brother sulks. Now, in Rembrandt's picture, he's not really outside, although it's hard to tell just whether this is an a court scene or just what. But in the parable, he's outside the Father's house. And therefore, in some sense, he's really outside the Father's will. Neither Jonah or the elder brother like the free mercy of God. Why? Because it calls their nationalistic and moral superiority into question. Think about it. What could make a Southern Baptist KKK member angrier than to have to offer God's mercy to a black community? It is inconceivable. What could make a Nazi angrier than to have to take the mercy of God to a Jewish ghetto? What could make a nationalistic, moral, majority, Christian, American, or perhaps even an evangelical Christian angrier than to have to bear the news of divine forgiveness to Tehran or any member of the Taliban? It would be inconceivable. And that's the problem. To us right-minded Christians, it's inconceivable. What's inconceivable? Not that somebody would go to Tehran. What's inconceivable to us is that God would show mercy on anyone who is a part of the Taliban. It would be inconceivable for any of us. And yet, who in this room is to say that that's not what God intends to do? I certainly wouldn't want to go there, but if you're a betting person, hey, go for it. Jesus Christ said, love your enemies and do good to those who hate you. And bless those who curse you. The Taliban curses us every day. They curse us more than we curse them. I mean, they get paid to curse. And pray for those who abuse you. Jesus praised a Samaritan who stopped to help a needy Jew. So here's what I think God is saying. Listen, you pity the plant, Jonah? You didn't labor over it. You didn't make it grow. It came and went in one night. Just like your stock portfolios. I'm making way too much of that. Of course not. But Jonah, I did labor over Nineveh. I did make it grow. And I've been at work on Nineveh not one night, but for years and years. And shouldn't I pity its 120,000 people and all of its cattle? Shouldn't I be angry if this city fails to give me glory? If you are angry that your plant no longer gives you shade, who do you think gave food to the cattle and wisdom to the calves so they know how to suckle from birth? Was it not I, the Lord? I don't want these cattle to go up in the smoke of judgment. Jonah, forsake your racism. Give up your self-righteous attitude. Forsake your nationalism and follow me. You owe your life to me. Therefore, be merciful as your Father in heaven is merciful. A number of years ago, a woman lost her only son to a shooting. And the perpetrator was African American. Now, this white woman was raised to hate anybody that was overtly different from her, but especially black people. Her father raised her to show contempt for all blacks and reminded her day in and day out of how evil and awful blacks were. She was raised on it, and her aunts and her uncles and her mother and her siblings all grew up on the same dribble of all that was evil and wrong and suspicious and ungodly and unclean about black people. So her son is shot by a black adolescent. And he goes to court, and he stands up in court, and he does a kind of come to Jesus 11th hour plea. And demonstrates a contrite heart and weeps, and he's broken over it, but the sentence is clear. So off to jail he goes. Now that woman, bred on hate, by the way, her husband, who had since left her, was also a very hateful man. This woman found herself waking up at night, but not waking up thinking about her son. She ended up waking up at night thinking about this boy whose family had completely deserted him, and him living in prison. So for 11 years, think of all that raw sewage in her background. For 11 years, every Friday afternoon, she took 2 hours off of work early, so didn't get paid for those 2 hours, and drove to the jail and spent 1 hour with this black adolescent who then eventually grew to live into his 20s. And she came to love this man, and he came to love her, and they began to develop this deep and profound friendship to the point where he almost identified her as his mother, and he reflected to her own son. When he was finally released, she took him into her house and cared for him and helped him to find a job, and now is living married with children and so forth. Now, I tell you that story not because it's a big bang dramatic story, but I think it's precisely the way it should be, because it goes against everything that we would expect to happen. It's the great unexpected. And that's the way it is with God. God always does the expected. It's unexpected because every one of us in this room have predetermined how God is going to behave, who he likes and who he doesn't like, and therefore who you should like and who you shouldn't like. You have predetermined that whatever church you belong to, all those other denominations don't have it quite right. And God agrees with you. Heaven knows he does. Of course he agrees with you. But the unexpected is that, doggone it, God loves them too. And so my question to you, back to this picture, is, truth be told, who are you in this picture? If you have any traces of racism in you, who are you in this picture? If any of you have any traces of self-righteousness, that you somehow hold the moral high ground over a lot of other people that you know. If any of you have thought while I was talking here tonight that you sure wished your roommate had been here, who are you in this picture? That's all I want to ask you tonight. Because Jonah is in this picture. And the question is, are we in this picture? Here's the second follow-up question. Where in this picture do you want to be? Where do you want to be? What's it going to take for you to get to where you want to be? Well, I want to suggest to you that if you're still standing straight after this message, if you're still standing erect after the Jonah story, if you're still standing up tall and straight and erect after hearing this parable, you are not in the best of places. So how are you going to get from where you are to where you think God is calling you to be? Or to put it another way, where is your head resting right now? Is it resting in a place where you can hear the heartbeat of God, the Father? Father, we have traced the journey of Jonah, and we have found ourselves in the story. Woe unto us who lament the dying of a shade plant over the potential destruction of another human being. Have we become so lost, so confused as to what should matter to us? Father, my prayer for all of us here tonight is that we would be awakened to once again learn to love the things that you love. Thank you for loving us and the people of Nineveh. Amen.